Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
From Cabernet to Mont-Lay, they're here to slay the art history babes.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Corey.
I'm Natalie.
I'm Jen.
And I'm Ginny. And we are the Art History Babes.
Today, we are doing the second installment of our two-parter on color theory. Woo-woo, colors!
Color so theory! Much to say.
There is so much to say.
By colors.
Colors.
We could go on forever and ever. There's so much to say about color. Our second episode, we're going to kind of dive into color theory and modernism, particularly Joseph Albers and his work in color theory. Then we're going to talk a little bit more about psychology and color. And then we're going to wrap it all up with Van Gogh.
A little bit about our man, Van Gogh.
Our boy, Vincent.
God, Van Gogh.
We all love you. We love you so much. So our last episode, we talked a lot about color, perception, optics, a little bit about Isaac Newton. Then we got into the color blue.
Oh,
we went
God.
On some interesting tangents with the color blue. But we
angled up in blue.
Bob, I love you.
It was great.
It was great, though. We learned a lot of things about blue. We had some good conversation about blue. So now we're kind of bringing it back around to color theory and how color theory relates to art. So color theory, when you hear the phrase color theory, it is referring to how color is used in the visual arts. It is referring to how colors interact with one another and create certain effects. Some kind of basics of color theory, and this stuff's kind of confusing, but you may have heard of additive and subtractive color. Additive color refers to when you start with black and you add light to create color. Subtractive color is kind of the opposite. It's you start with white and then you add colors. And the reason it's referred to as subtractive is because what happens is you end up with black. Because the color wavelengths absorb one another. So that's how it becomes subtractive. It's a little confusing, like you're adding color, but it's subtractive, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
When you're creating visual art, you're either going to take kind of like an additive approach, which is like, honestly, like television and film is additive. You're adding light to something, whereas painting is subtractive.
This gets really important also to printmakers in
particular,
because they're constantly, depending on the particular type of printmaking medium, dealing with additive and subtractive medium. It gets complicated.
And speaking of printmaking, as we talked about in the last episode, your primary colors, your general primary colors are red, yellow, and blue. Those are your typical primary colors. But in printmaking, and they're kind of like the new primary colors, it's just in like printing in general, you have the CMYK primaries, which is cyan, magenta, yellow, and black. And those are the primaries that you deal with in printmaking.
Why is black K?
I don't know. Just what it is, I guess.
Okay. Well,
if you know out there, let us know.
Let us know why black is K.
Yeah, that'd be great. But so you have the RYB, red, yellow, blue, and then you have CMYK, which is the primary colors of printing, cyan, magenta, yellow, and black. I keep mentioning Joseph Albers very important in the development of color theory. He was born in 1888 and died in 1976. He was an artist and an instructor, a modern artist. He entered the Bauhaus in 1920, which is a very important institution for kind of the bridge between art and craft in the early 1900s. He worked in a lot of mediums. He worked in furniture design. He worked in stained glass. So he's very interested in this intersection of craft and art. He had a lifelong interest in problems of light and color within geometric forms. And if you've ever seen any of his work at a museum, like, that's very obvious. It's very, very geometric, very clear use of colors against one another, very intentional use of color. So that was kind of his passion and what he was the most interested in, really, was color theory. He wrote The Interaction of Color, first published in 1963, and I'm going to read you a little bit of it. It's a fascinating book. It's super interesting from both, I mean, from color theory, from an artistic perspective, but also from just a philosophical perspective. It's super interesting. So I'm going to start just kind of reading the first page of the introduction because I think it's really poignant. The book Interaction of Color is a record of an experimental way of studying color and of teaching color. In visual perception, a color is almost never seen as it really is, as it physically is. This fact makes color the most relative medium in art. In order to use color effectively, it is necessary to recognize that color deceives continually. To this end, the beginning is not a study of color systems. First, it should be learned that one and the same color evokes innumerable readings. Instead of mechanically applying or merely implying laws and rules of color harmony, distinct color effects are produced through recognition of the interaction of color by making, for instance, two very different colors look alike or nearly alike. The aim of such study is to develop, through experience, by trial and error, an eye for color. This means specifically seeing color action as well as feeling color relatedness. As a general training, it means development of observation and articulation. This book, therefore, does not follow an academic conception of theory and practice. It reverses this order and places practice before theory, which, after all, is the conclusion of practice. Also, the book does not begin with optics and physiology of visual perception, nor with any presentation of the physics of light and wavelength. So,
was that written by Albers?
Yeah.
That is very quintessential vocabulary of the Bauhaus school.
Definitely.
They're just, everything they wrote was like a manifesto.
Yeah, for real, for real. So the last episode, we went into all these things about color perception and science. This both does apply and doesn't apply. This is kind of the modernist way of flipping all that on its head and taking what we assumed color perception to be and playing with it, I think is the best way to put it. It was about experimenting and playing with it. And that's kind of what this book does. It kind of lists these different experiments that Joseph Albers would do with his students to get them to look at color differently. He would do different like experiments, different optical illusions that he would do. One of the most common ones that you very well may have seen before is he would do the whole, he would take two rectangles of the same color and place them on different backgrounds. And this would result in the two rectangles looking like different colors. And that's like a very common optical illusion that people will do to just kind of like mess with your perception. Like, because it makes you think that the rectangles are different colors, but they're not. But he would kind of take it to a new level and he would have his students play with colors to find which colors would best achieve that effect. Like which colors would best create this contrast and best make you think that they were the same color or different colors. And so it was all about like playing with different colors. So he was really big on like color mixture and he worked a lot with his students with like paper instead of like paint, which is a kind of an interesting medium to play with color mixture on, because you can't mix paper, obviously. So, like, one quote from his book, like, in relation to this whole, like, using paper to study color, he says, though this may first appear as a handicap, it is actually a challenge to study color mixture in our imagination, that is to say, with eyes closed. So it was quite literally a way of him to say, like, I need you to see these colors in your mind and, like, work through them and play with them. He was all about color combinations, the different effects they had. A lot of his work, and we'll put a few of his images up on our website, but he played with color and how it could create depth and layering. A lot of his work is very simple, but it just does really cool things optically. And that kind of relates to what got me on this whole color thing, which was the quilt exhibit I saw in San Diego.
Right.
Quilts and Color at the San Diego Museum of Art, but the exhibit itself is from the Museum of Fine Arts Boston. And the exhibit was really well done. It was all of these quilts, but it included, like, a color wheel. It included some history on Joseph Albers and, like, how he relates to all this. The whole exhibit consisted of quilts ranging from, like, the 19th century into early mid-20th century. Mm. What was really fascinating and really just, like, striking about it is, like, some of these quilts did some really crazy things optically. Like, you would look at quilts. I bought, because I'm a child of capitalism, and I can't say no to art museum.
I spent $150 at the Met when I was there.
Can't put a price on culture.
And I bought a bunch of crap.
But yeah, art museum gift shops.
I'm so guilty of that.
God. But I bought these pins that I now have on my purse.
So precious.
Thanks. And they were from this quilt exhibit. But, like, see, look at this. They're like these three-dimensional squares, and that, like, that's from a quilt. Like, that's a quilt that looked like that.
Now, are those, like, modern quilts, or are they from, like, the old-timey quilting bees of the colonial United States?
Everyone has a picture in their head.
Kind of
right
in
now.
The middle. Like, they're 19th century through early 20th century.
Okay.
So we're not really talking past 1950.
Okay.
And some of them had really dazzling optical effects. You're just like, damn, like, that's a crazy quilt. And it was from use of color theory and, like, putting these things to use in their craft, which was really cool and inspired this episode. So that's kind of a little rundown on Joseph Albers and his contribution to color theory. I think we're going to shift into color theory and psychology.
Hello, listeners. Okay, so my main resource was this book that I found that I loved. It has many editions, but it's called Art and Visual Perception, A Psychology of the Creative Eye by Rudolf Arnheim. And the artist that I looked at don't necessarily think of color in the same way as Albers, as far as using color specifically to express their ideas. So I looked at Mark Rothko, and also my boy Gerhard Richter, who I just love, for using being known as these kind of abstract expressionists who use colors, and specifically, they're really good crackers, guys. specifically, primary colors in terms of Gerhard Richter's later works that really are associated with abstract expressionism.
Who else used primary? Poussin used primary color.
Oh, God.
Honestly?
What do you got to say, Denny?
He didn't have the complementary colors thing down.
I dislike Poussin.
I do too. I'm not a big fan, but I do love, what was the one, the main one? It's at it's in Minneapolis. Germanicus? Death of Germanicus.
Yeah.
I like that one.
Fuck.
But you're also you're the only person who's seen it in person.
That's true.
So that could be.
That's true. Yeah. That changes shit.
Maybe it doesn't look as shitty and two dimensional in real life.
A lot of people hate on Rothko when you don't see it in person.
No, Rothko in real life is transformative.
It's a world apart from seeing it through a screen. This is, you know, something the internet cannot duplicate.
It really can.
But I think it's really easy to think of Rothko as an artist who's super focused on color, and it's interesting to start reading, you know, his own words where he emphasizes specifically that he's not. And I have this one quote that I thought summed it up pretty nicely. And he said, "I'm not an abstractionist. I'm not interested in the relationship of color or form or anything else. I'm interested only in expressing basic human emotions, tragedy, ecstasy, doom, and so on." So this kind of segues into the whole idea of color and psychology, because while we've already gone into length in episode one about how it's hard to link certain colors with certain emotions universally, there is definitely a connection between color and emotion. And it is important to note that the color spectrum is a sliding scale. So we've talked about the science, but the way that people see colors is technically differently, and also the way that people interpret colors. If you think back to the, how do you say it, Rorschach? I always say it wrong.
Yeah.
Okay. I think Rorschach is correct.
Okay, Rorschach tests. So, you know, the ink block tests. He not only did he do tests with form, but also with color. So he was kind of comparing the two, and he found that there are certain people who are kind of more apt to form domination in as so far as they relate to items, and there are people who relate more to color dominance. So you can kind of go one of two ways. And I mean, it's really complex, but if you're going to break it down, there's form dominated and color dominated. And the people who show color dominance tend to have more openness to external stimuli. Mm. So these people could be described as more sensitive, easily influenced, unstable, disorganized, and given to emotional outbursts. Okay, and this is where it gets a little personal, because we have had conversations in the past amongst ourselves about our just personality types and tendencies toward
how
emotion.
How weird we are.
And how two of us, who I will not specifically name, might be a little dead inside because we don't feel emotions as readily.
And two of us are extremely color dominant.
Yeah. Just side note, we're a really cool balance of two super emotional women and two very cool-headed women. So
on a side note, fuck gender stereotypes, because we are like a platter of different... Yeah. Combinations of personality
Well,
types.
We've got all the elements represented right here.
Yes. Yeah.
Four of them.
So, yeah. So then the contrast would be shape-dominated or form-dominated people are kind of, you could describe them as more controlled or unemotional. So Rorschach didn't go any deeper into this avenue, but a guy, and I'm going to butcher his name, but his name is Ernest Chanchel.
Maybe.
Our boy Ernie took this idea a little bit deeper, and he decided that, let me read my shitty handwriting for a second. what? Color something.
Wait, let me see what you wrote. Where? Experience.
Is it experience?
It says experience.
Okay, so color experience it resembles like affect or emotion. So depending on the different person. It can kind of be, and that's all I wrote.
While Natalie is gathering her thoughts, I have a little thing to say about color theory. So we started on white wine, and which is not white, by the way. It's kind of like yellowy.
Which we know Jen does not like.
But I like the way it tastes, so that's okay. And now we're moving on to a red, and the red is actually kind of like purple. So, you know,
what happens when you mix red and yellow?
What does happen? I don't know. I don't want to know. You know, you know what happens, my friends? A gnarly wicked hangover. And they won't tell you that in the color theory class.
They won't.
This wine is called Textbook.
Yeah. Red wine.
Which is delicious.
That makes me think of another poem I'd like to recite.
Go for it, girl.
And then after that, we'll come back to Ernest because I found my spot.
Red wine goes to my head. Makes me forget that I still need her so. Sad. Red, red wine, it's up to you. All I can do, I've done. Memories won't go. Memories won't go. That's all I'll get into, but that's from UB40. So,
OG goes to Neil Diamond, by the way.
Oh,
have you not heard Neil Diamond's Red Red Wine? It's so good.
Okay, well, that's what we're going to be doing immediately after this episode,
for real.
Okay, back to Natalie.
Okay, so this goes. Okay, so back to kind of this idea of. I mean, I don't want to say, like, emotion versus, like, practicality or control, but it does kind of get down into that idea of, I liked the use of the term, like, external stimuli, so how things affect you, whether external stimuli really can affect you deeply or if it's something that...
That makes perfect sense.
Because that sounds, it's a lot better than acting like someone who's emotional is irrational or uncontrolled. Right. It's not...
As one of the emotional ones.
I'm triggered.
Oh.
As one of the emotional of the four, I think that's actually perfect because I feel like I've said that to people before. I am, like, so overwhelmed by, like, external stimuli all the time. I'm just like, colors and shapes and music and art and dance and I'm just,
and
like,
honestly, I
so
mean,
excited all the time.
It's, if I see someone's face and it looks kind of weird, I'm like, do they not like me? What's wrong?
I agree. It definitely, it has to do, my emotional responses to things very much have to do with the emotion of the stimuli I'm taking
and being
in,
and absorbing so much.
If you had any question about which two were which,
shut up, Natalie.
No, it's just like, I walk into a space and it's just like, I don't know. Honestly, if you've ever been to like an art museum with me, it's kind of ridiculous. I'm just like, ooh, painting. And then I'm over here. And I'm looking at this. I'm like, oh, I love this guy. And then I'm just like, I'm just like all over the place. And it's just like,
I cry sometimes.
Oh. I almost prefer going to like art museums by myself.
Me too. I do too.
So I can just like put in my headphones and just like.
See, mine is less emotional, but it's the same kind of idea that I like to be alone, but it's much more like technical. Like I just like, like I have to spend a lot of time with something.
Yeah, I'm not able to just look at a work of art and not know anything about it and feel some kind of emotional reaction to it, like a really profound one. Usually when I'm in museums, museum fatigue is a totally real thing, and it's a real thing.
So much.
Yeah, and it's a real thing for art historians. Like, it's a real thing for people that are really into art, where after a certain point, like, the stimuli is like, okay, I'm done. Your brain's like, all right, you've seen enough. Yeah, I don't cry.
I feel like that could be a whole, like, realm of curation is, like, trying to arrange a museum in a way to make people less burnt out. Like, less quickly. Does that make sense?
That's fascinating about curation.
Yeah,
I feel like that's what's going on with SF MoMA, everything I've heard about it. They're trying to make it really, like, contemporary and, like, hey, listen to these baseball players talk about art.
Or the cast of Silicon Valley.
Is Ehrlich Bachman there?
Yes. You can listen to the cast of Aviato. Silicon Valley
Aviato.
Tell you about the art at SF MoMA. So we're still in this place of emotion linked with color, and there's an idea that shape dominance, I'll start with color. Color dominance is a more passive form of thought. So colors come in more passively and you feel them, and that's why it's linked with emotion, whereas form kind of takes a more active form of thought. So to understand forms, you have to think more actively. So that's why color is linked. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So like, colors and emotions are both things that come over you without control, that sort of idea of outside stimuli. Whereas form is something that you have to more actively process and work your way through. And that's why, I guess dispassionate would be maybe a good word. Like people who kind of
That's so, like, the color is more inherent somehow, and, like, shape is more learned?
Like, if you're, like... No, oh. It's just, like, different ways of thinking. So, whether, like, the way... It's, like, coming over you... So, you're being passive. It's... You're not at all engaging with it. It just hits you. And you feel it, and it really gets to you. Whereas form is something you have to more actively seek out the reaction you get from it.
Gotcha.
Does that make sense? Yeah. You don't look at a form and necessarily, like, have that inherent whatever. It doesn't wash over you. You have to work through it.
Mm-hmm.
Color is something that hits you the same way emotion does. It can be inexplicable. It can be without warning, without want.
It does make sense.
It, you know, it just depends. And but it's also something that can be entirely satisfying, that feeling of not necessarily seeking it out, but having it.
Definitely.
You know, it's not a negative thing. It's just there are different ways of getting something out of art or something visual. And they, I mean, it's so complicated because they work together, and it gets super complicated when you get into patterns and whether a pattern is color dominant or form dominant. And they, you know, you can get into some really interesting ideas. I mean, everything basically works on a spectrum from simple to complex, whether it's colors, whether it's patterns. It's just, it's all very interesting, and this could go on for much longer, but...
That's really interesting.
Yeah, that's super interesting.
It's a good way to think about how different people react to things in a scientific way that doesn't... I don't like when things are simplified to a point where it makes one seem right and one seem wrong.
Yeah,
well, you know,
what you're saying...
There's no hierarchy. It's they're related in a way.
What you're saying about color and how it is somehow indicative of some sort of reaction or emotion is... reminding me about our artist of the moment on this episode, which is Mr. Van Gogh, Vincent Van Gogh.
In case you didn't know.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if you were confusing him with a different Van Gogh, but we're talking about Vincent. Okay? And Vincent Van Gogh is somebody who has been the subject of a lot of intense study, not only among art historians, but also among fine artists. Psychologists, however, are very interested in Vincent Van Gogh because of his use of color. So, before I get deeper into that, I have this really, since we're reading, like, poetry or, you know, lyrics to UB40 songs, I have a great poem about Vincent Van Gogh. It's by one of my favorite poets, Charles Bukowski.
Bukowski.
So Bukowski wrote
I love
this
him and
poem.
I hate him. I don't even know how to feel.
I love him and I hate him and I love him.
I know, right?
And that describes my relationship with men. Anyway, Charles Bukowski wrote this poem. It's called Working Out. Van Gogh cut off his ear, gave it to a prostitute, who flung it away in extreme disgust. Van, whores don't want ears. They want money. I guess that's why you were such a great painter. You didn't understand much else.
Ooh.
And
was that a burn?
It's sort of a burn, but
I don't know if it's a burn.
It's not really, because Vincent Van Gogh was absolutely clinically obsessed with color. How do we know this? We know this because throughout his entire life, he maintained a constant dialogue with his brother Theo, his little brother, who was also his patron and his main financial source.
His brother really, and then his brother's wife after his brother died really perpetuated his success, but that's a side note. Sorry. Continue.
So Vincent and Theo had a very close relationship, and because of this, thousands of letters exist that Vincent and Theo wrote to one
another. What's the collection? Letters to Theo, I think, is the collection of
A lot of them. And I mean, it's super amazing, and the letters are just great. And there's a movie, actually, that we need to watch. The movie's not, no, don't watch Letters to Theo, the movie. That one's dumb, but the movie I'm thinking about is a documentary, sort of, but it's entirely images of, like, where Van Gogh, like, traveled and stuff, and so it was made in, like, the 70s, And so it's this really kind of like artsy film of just different areas and sort of like recreations of scenes in which Van Gogh would have like made like a tavern where it's all dark and people are drinking absinthe. And so anyway, in this film, it's entirely all the dialogue is just letters that Van Gogh wrote to his brother and voiced by some very talented
British person,
yes.
How
absolutely.
How did I know?
Yeah. I will
British voice everything.
I will find the name of this film and we'll put it on the website. But back to Van Gogh and his obsession with color. So he studied intensely the artist Eugène Delacroix. So Delacroix. Is that?
Delacroix.
You got it. Delacroix.
I never studied French, so my bad. Good. But
I did for a minute.
Good job.
I'm still going strong on Duolingo.
Oh, hey, good idea.
I am 16% fluent.
Oh,
Duolingo. If you want to sponsor us, we're okay.
We're totally cool.
We would
cool.
love to be sponsored by Duolingo.
I would put that little bird on
we're
everything.
We're biggest fans.
We're big fans.
The
of
little
Duolingo.
Green owl.
Oh, it's an owl.
I think.
Sometimes you it's can like if you get enough points, you can get like a little costume for him. Like he a little monocle.
I've never gotten that many points.
Yeah, you get enough points, you get a little monocle for him.
So that is the sign of education.
Oh, the universal sweet. Sign of intelligence.
Does he get a top
monocle.
Hat too?
Maybe, actually.
I would want right. a bowler. Could I get a bowler hat?
I'm going to look it up. You keep talking about Van Gogh.
So I'm actually a little interesting. Some little information on Delacroix. He was a very famous in France. He's understood as a romantic artist. And the reason why he's so important is because his work really did inform a large portion of the Impressionist circle, which follows sort of this era of Romanticism, which it's not a continual timeline. There's all kinds of aberrations in the history of the development of different styles. But Delacroix was one of the first to develop his own art color theories, and these included juxtaposing spots of color rather than blending the two colors or tints together into a gradient. By doing this, Delacroix's strokes of color were then being blended by the eye of the viewer. So that's huge when trying to understand not only the work of Van Gogh, but also the work of the Impressionists in general, who were absolutely obsessed with light and color and how For the real. Eye is perceiving color and how we mix colors in our eyes when we see two tones put together. Which is fascinating. And so because of Delacroix's brushstrokes and his technique, Vincent van Gogh then applied many of those concepts to his own color theory. And it comes to be known as something called the law of simultaneous contrast. And the law of simultaneous contrast is what I just mentioned, which is the act of putting two contrasting colors together in order to achieve optical blending. So this color theory can be seen in his works such as The Potato Eaters, which is a fascinating piece, one of his earlier pieces, and also in a later piece called The Bedroom.
My parents used to have a copy of that.
Of The Bedroom?
Yeah.
I love that painting.
That was like my first exposure to Vincent Van Gogh.
Can I tell a story, a Van Gogh story?
Yes.
I was in Chicago, and there was a really amazing exhibit at the Chicago Institute of Art, or is it Art Institute? Great museum. But they did this exhibit because they have one copy of The Bedroom. Mm. And then another copy belongs to the Van Gogh Museum. And I forgot who the third copy belongs to. Anyways, they did this exhibit. It opened in February. And it was the first time all three copies of The Bedroom were going to be shown together.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was kind of a big deal. And they did this exhibit, and actually it was really cool, Airbnb, like, they worked with Airbnb, and they recreated the bedroom, like,
oh my
in
God.
A room, and it was really trippy, and, like, they
take all my money.
They rented it out to people. It was, I mean, I didn't actually get to see it, but I saw, like, pictures of it. You can Google it, and it was really trippy, like, I'm because sure. they recreated it to look like the painting. So, yeah, there was a cool campaign, but, yeah, they showed all three versions of The Bedroom together. Hmm. And it opened in February, and I was there, and on opening day, we were going to go see the exhibit, right? And we go all the way down there, and it's like a blizzard outside. It's snowing so hard, and it's so unbelievably cold. Chicago in February is miserable.
No.
And it was so cold, so windy.
I don't do cold.
I've already adapted to West Coast ways, so, like, I wasn't even prepared. I was in, like, a tiny little coat.
It's
and
amazing
I was like,
how quickly
I know, I right? Say, I was yeah. like, I should have known better. But anyways, it was so cold, blizzarding. It was kind of gorgeous because, like, falling snow is beautiful, but it was still, like, so cold. And so we get there. And there's a Starbucks right across the street. We stop in to get coffee, and there's a line all the way down the block in the middle of a blizzard. People outside, Jesus. Waiting in line outside of the museum all the way down the block.
No, and people and get hyped over
I
Van
know.
Gogh.
And I just, like, we got our coffee, and I was like, we're not going to stand in that line. We're going to come back tomorrow. And I, like, started to cry because I was just like, because.
You were thinking about our pal Van Gogh.
Exactly. He was so sad and he was so depressed his whole life. And he didn't, like, sell, like, anything. And
he, like, was hungry, dude.
Yeah, he was. And he just had, like, such a sad life. And for him to, like, I just wish he could have seen these people, like, lining up in a blizzard to go see his paintings. It was just really emotional.
No,
honestly, no. This is a time where I wish that there was a camera suspended over us, because while Jen and Corey are, like, crying right now, Natalie and I are just, like, sitting here, like,
Jenny was
like
on her
androids.
Phone.
To be fair, I was looking up, to be fair. I do think at some point we should do an episode of, like, female art patrons, because Van Gogh's sister-in-law was Johanna van Gogh Bonger, I don't know.
Bonger?
But she, I don't know, guys. But she was, like, very, very instrumental in making Van Gogh, like, a famous name, because as many of us know, he was not really an artist of, like, reputation or fame until after he was already dead.
Man, I get really torn up about Van Gogh because...
So do I.
He's,
like,
just,
regularly.
Like, such a good guy, and, like, nobody, like, cares about his work.
I know, but...
I mean, they do now, but, like, at the time, he was, like, starting, and, like, no one cared, and his brother... His brother was just, like, financing it, and he was just like, why can't I sell? He sold, like, two paintings, and he was just hungry, and I just,
and he made such beautiful art.
He was just, like, a hungry guy. Anyway, no, I'm sorry, I'm, like, crying and laughing. I'm really sad about Van Gogh.
He was hungry, and he was emotional, and he just, like, was sad, and you're just like, damn it.
You're, like, losing it. Well, what really bums me out about Van Gogh is that to this day, he's known as the crazy guy who cut his fucking ear off. Which, by the way, I have a good story.
I feel so bad because I just made, like, a joke about this on social media the other day.
Wow, you need to get out of your own house, Natalie.
I thought it was pretty funny, though.
Oh my God.
No, but for real. Okay, so the story goes that Van Gogh was probably schizophrenic and that he was a depressed, anxious, angry person. But... one thing about Van Gogh is that he loved hard. And he had a best friend, you guys.
He loved him.
And he loved his best friend, Paul Gauguin.
Digressing.
I know, but it's important. Wait, but I want to talk about Paul Gauguin. Gauguin was kind of a piece of shit, and Van Gogh would get, like, so hurt over his best friend being, like, very insensitive and just not being a good friend and making him feel like he wasn't, you know, a good artist. And so the story goes that Van Gogh cut his ear off and gave it to a prostitute. That is not true. There is evidence that suggests that Van Gogh actually had his ear cut off by Gauguin in a sword fight in a bar. And Van Gogh felt so bad about this fight with his friend, and then he didn't want people to hate his best friend.
Oh my God.
So he swore an oath of silence to never speak of how Gauguin cut his ear off because it was his best friend. It was like his best friend. And he loved his best friend so much. He was like, I know you cut my ear off, but we're best friends, and I'll just lie and say that I was crazy and I cut it off myself. That's what happened.
No,
this is real.
I would literally throw any of you under the bus if you fucking cut my ear.
Do you? Okay, like
I have evidence to corroborate this.
You've got the research.
Yes. Okay. This is gonna go on the website. No. I promise. But okay. Anyway, enough of that. But the reason why this is important, the reason why this is relevant, is because of Van Gogh's association with mental illness, and because of his ear situation, psychologists have since wanted to find evidence of Van Gogh's mental instability in his works of art. Okay, we're back. There are several articles and psychological journals with abstracts and everything, like real articles that are very much trying to find a relationship between the increasing intensity of Van Gogh's colors in his later work and what we know to be his increasingly deteriorating, does that make sense? Increasingly deteriorating?
Yeah.
Anyway, deteriorating mental state later in his life, which we have evidence of because of several periods of being institutionalized, letters to his brother. So it's safe to say that Vincent van Gogh suffered from mental illness. Therefore, though, now much of his work is characterized as being so intense because there's a correspondence between his emotional intensity and the intensity of his visual representations. So these, especially color, so the color and the intensity of the color and the quality of the line and all of the space, the way he treats his space, there's these really, like, disorienting, the name of the work eludes me, but, the interior of the bar with the pool table,
yeah, totally.
and the light. So yeah. That work is very...
we'll post that on the website.
Yeah, that work is very disorienting because of this, so like, just jarring yellow of the fluorescent light over the pool table and the way that the space is at once deep but shallow. All of this evidence is...
It's Night Cafe.
Night Cafe by Vincent van Gogh. So this evidence serves then to be like a potentially... works as a potentially quantifiable link between his mental functioning and his creative output, which makes a lot of sense. According to some basic color theory, color has three physical dimensions, which are wavelength, intensity, and purity. According to a article on Psychology Art Journal, which sounds so interesting as a journal, I want to subscribe to it. So according to this article, these three physical dimensions of color correspond to three psychological elements, which then become hue, brightness, and saturation. So Van Gogh's work shows a distinctive change in all of these psychological features. And therefore, the intensity of his color represents a change in his emotional experience. There's a lot of science behind this.
I'm not discrediting it, but one must also consider Van Gogh as a great man of letters, and he studied and he was obsessed with color.
For sure.
And to reduce Van Gogh's complexity in his understanding of color theory to being merely a reflection of his deteriorating mental state is so just, it does no justice to the man. And he was very, very read in color theory of his time. One author to consider, someone that Van Gogh absolutely read, was the author Michel Eugène Chevreul. And his writings on color theory really influenced Van Gogh as well as Delacroix. And so what we are left with was a man who, as his career went on, not a very successful career, but he continued to paint because he was so obsessed with color and he was so obsessed with trying to find some sort of fundamental truth through color in his work, that he continued to paint. And I read somewhere his output was so insane that he is reported to have painted 70 canvases in 70 days.
Hot damn shit.
It's probably hyperbole, but, you know, he painted a lot. Little bit about the bedroom. So this painting is from 1888, painted in October. It's one of Van Gogh's best-known paintings, and it exemplifies this law of simultaneous contrasts. So Van Gogh wrote to his brother Theo and stated that the purpose of this work was to show expressive contrasting colors and translate them into emotion onto paint. So what we're left with today is not quite the way Van Gogh would have painted it. The walls, originally violet, have faded prematurely. The red in the purple paint faded, and it left behind a mostly blue tint. Due to that fading, the balance between the primary colors and their complementary contrasts is disrupted. But the painting has since been restored, and we have a pretty good knowledge of the way it was supposed to look. So the contrasting yellow of the chairs and the bed serves as a direct contrast to the violet of the walls. And this contrast draws your eye to the yellow, and the purple walls have this effect of softening the image, and therefore the work becomes smooth and sort of balances out. And it becomes a soothing sort of scene, which is not that characteristic of many Vincent Van Gogh paintings. And recently, something very interesting that I came across was an article by the Smithsonian that suggested that Van Gogh might have been partially colorblind. So the Smithsonian had a installation where they had a room where people could go in, and the room simulated what it would feel like to be colorblind. And in the room, they had a copy of Starry Night. And one author who wrote the blog, which I'm referencing here, stated that when he saw Starry Night through this filter of what it would look like to be colorblind, or, you know, color deficient, as we've also heard it be called, he suddenly saw the work as a more like smooth, cohesive piece, as opposed to this sort of, you know, there's some jarring uses of yellows and greens, and there's times in certain works by Van Gogh where you're like, oh god, like, why did he put that color there? It's so blah, like, it's just, you know, that sometimes some of his colors tend to, like, grate on the eye. And what this author describes is a more serene scene of the Starry Night. So you know, this isn't evidence necessarily that Vincent Van Gogh was colorblind in any way, but
it's an interesting theory.
Yeah, it is.
Definitely.
And back to this whole, like, idea of color dominance versus shape dominance, they talk about how people who are less color dominant can actually be more apt to depression. Hmm. So color dominance, aka this idea that you're a more passive thinker, like you let things come over you passively, is actually further away from depression, which is interesting because I feel like people tend to like the idea that emotional people are the ones that would get depressed, and that's not what this
there's also kind of this, I mean, depression is obviously a super complicated thing, but depression can also result in, like, a lack of feeling, like, in a...
Exactly. Right. So because, like a numbness. And there are different reasons for it. But, yeah, but that could be a reason, is if you can't feel those things that colors may necessarily allow certain people to feel, then that...
Because the whole thing with being an emotional person that I think, unfortunately, like, it does tend to get a bad rap sometimes... But, like, when you're an emotional person, you feel the good emotions really intensely, too, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's, like, I don't know, it's not as scary as I think it's made out to be sometimes. And, yeah, I think depression can more be characterized by numbness than, like, so feeling.
Maybe a lack of color. If Van Gogh, this is a big if, obviously, but if he was colorblind, that could maybe have something to do with his perceived depression.
For sure.
Because,
Yeah. I think it would be kind of cool to wrap up the episode with a mention of the New Black. Have you heard of the New Black?
No.
It is called Vanta Black, and it is the blackest black you have ever seen. So
is it blacker than obsidian?
It's blacker than black times
is
a
it
million.
Blacker than a black hole?
Maybe. So, a couple things just about Vanta Black. It's the darkest material ever made by man, and it absorbs virtually all light. So, it was developed by a British company.
How's it do that?
Okay. I'm about to tell you. It was created by a British company called Surrey Nanosystems to eliminate stray light in satellites and telescopes. But it has since gathered a following of artists, designers, and other curious creatives.
Because we love wearing black.
Curious creatives.
That's cute, right? So, it's not a color. It's really not a color because the way that we understand color is that it is the result of the way light reflects off of an object into our eyes. So, that doesn't happen with Vanta Black because the light is absorbed. So, different light frequencies typically translate into different colors. But Vanta Black is not a color. It's a material. It's made of a forest, quote unquote, of tiny hollow carbon tubes, each the width of a single atom. How? I don't know.
I don't understand.
Someone explain this to us, please.
Yeah, so according to the Surrey Nanosystems website, a surface area of 1 centimeter squared would contain around 1,000 million nanotubes. That sounds like a made-up number. So anyway, that means that Vanta Black is the absence of color, which is crazy because this is essentially what we would see if... materials weren't reflecting light waves. So could it be that our universe is just really black and dark and scary?
In my wildest dreams.
That's really interesting.
That is really interesting.
I really want, like, a dress made out of this stuff.
Yeah.
It'd be crazy.
This reminds me of another poem.
Oh, Jesus.
It's not a poem, it's a song. You'll probably recognize it. I see a red door and I want it painted black. No colors anymore, I want them to turn black. I see the girls walk by dressed in their summer clothes. I have to turn my head until my darkness goes.
Oh,
and,
bless you.
Yeah.
And on that note... I think that's a perfect way to wrap up our two-parter on color theory.
Thank you all.
Thanks so for hanging with us, guys.
Thanks,
even
guys.
All the ridiculousness.
I don't know. I think we literally cannot go on.
So, yeah, so that was just a little kind of peek into the world of color theory. Yeah. Honestly, it could go on forever and ever and ever. Mm-hmm.
It hurts my mind.
It does. But we suggest you open up a bottle of wine and talk about color with your friends, because it leads to interesting places. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being awesome. We appreciate all of you so much.
We love you.
We do.
So much
Thank
love.
You. And so much love.
Please appreciate Van Gogh.
You said that so softly. I know. He deserves it.
He deserves it. He was a good man. Go see a Van Gogh.
Good night.
Bye. From Cal.